The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield. This Money Show, of course, is brought to you by ABSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. ABSA is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. Looking forward to being in your company tonight on a day where, finally, there's been a little bit of honesty in the SAA Takatso deal. More than 2 years after it was first proposed, the deal is off, and what a mess it has been. I cannot help but be very cynical about some people within government's intentions as to whether or not the deal would ever have happened. And if you don't consummate a relationship within 2 years, odds are it's never going to happen. The SAA Takatso deal, announced February, I think it was early February of 2022, is off. It was supposed to be a showcase privatisation of a state-owned entity. It was going to be this great big announcement, and it's been a mess ever since it was announced. The buyers were meant to get control. They were meant to provide capital for growth. There's been lots of to-ing and fro-ing on price. There's been to-ing and fro-ing on conditions. Last week, apparently, there was the mutual consent, said Pravin Gordhan earlier today, that there was no path forward. Post-COVID, there was a sense within some people within government that the valuation should be higher. Because, and again, SAA is flying again. But the deal was done in difficult times. That's when deals are done. And you've got then political pressure, and you've got political posturing, and you've got politicians messing in commercial transactions, which they've got no job in doing, frankly. SAA now becomes the problem of National Treasury again. Should it choose, of course, should South Africa even choose to keep it going? Unless, of course, they embark on a whole new arrangement, which I struggle to see, because once you breach trust in the way that has been breached here, years into an agreement, it doesn't look like any deal will be in the offing. What a pity. SAA has its wings clipped once again. Is it sustainable on its own? History suggests otherwise. Welcome to The Money Show.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Well, JD Sports is coming to South Africa via the Fushini Group. The Fushini Group already has various interests in sports goods. They own Total Sports. They have got Sports Scene and Sneaker Factory. They're bringing in JD Sports as a fourth, sort of, I suppose, arrow in the quiver, if you like. JD Sports, a bit of a mix in my mind anyway, of Total Sports and Sportsman's Warehouse, carrying branded goods, Nike, North Face, all of the regular stuff. They've also got a very compelling private label range too. Anthony Thunstrom is the chief executive at the Fushini Group. What is it that JD Sports is going to be bringing into the Fushini Group and South Africa's sporting arena? Anthony, good evening.
Good evening, Bruce, to you and your listeners. Great to be back on the show. Bruce, I think the background is JD Sports, I think for anyone who's travelled internationally, particularly recently into the UK, the US, Australia, very much the preeminent sports lifestyle street culture business pretty much in the world. They have got incredibly strong and deep relationships with some of the leading sports and sportswear brands in the world, think Nike, Adi, Puma, etc. They, you know, just due to their size and scale, they do get a lot of product from those brands that are pretty much exclusive to their chain, not available, highly sought after in a segment of the market that's been growing well ahead of the rest of retail for pretty much most of the last decade. They're going to be bringing that level of exclusive product to the South African consumer via this this arrangement with TFG.
And you operating on a franchise model, so you bring it in, you run it, you pay them a royalty, and if there's anything left over, that goes to the Fushini Group bottom line.
Absolutely, and it really is plugging them into, I guess, our retail ecosystem. I think in South Africa, we've got, I think, the largest rewards customer base in the country now. We're sitting at about 36 million South Africans signed up to TFG rewards out of, I don't know, 62, 63 million people. Credit is still incredibly important to the South African consumer. We run a tightly controlled, but still small, relatively large credit book. And then we've got, you know, the best part of 3,700 stores across South Africa. So the actual physical running of the stores is something we do really well. They're also going to go online once we've opened stores. And, you know, our Bash platform that we launched beginning of last year has really grown from strength to strength. So I think if you kind of line up those assets in our quiver, there's a lot to really support the JD rollout in South Africa.
First store by year end, have you identified the location, the size, the space, the concept completely?
We've got I think there'll be more than one, Bruce, before the end of the year, probably three or four, without giving away too much. If you think of the tier one shopping centres across the country, those are the most likely starting places. The size of store will typically be somewhere between 700 and 900 square metres. If you look at some of the big JD sports stores in, for example, Oxford Street, those can be 2,500, 3,000 square metres. But I think we want to start this relatively conservatively.
But a warehousey sort of concept, bigger than a shop, smaller than a warehouse, somewhere in between then?
Yeah, absolutely.
Anthony Thunstrom, thank you. He is the chief executive at the Fushini Group.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Well, I enjoyed the Reserve Bank Governor Lesitja Khanyaho's confidence this morning, expressing his belief that South Africa will be removed from the International Financial Crime Watchdog, the Financial Action Task Force grey list, within the next year. He says the work identified by the organization will be completed at the next review, which happens in 2025. He was speaking at the Financial Sector Conduct Authority industry conference earlier. Now, you may be thinking that grey listing doesn't affect you, but it does. And I like the way the governor positioned it. By virtue of the fact that the integrity of the South African financial system is called into question, what it does is it deters investment, increases the cost of doing business. It's that easy. And ultimately, if it's harder to do business, everything will cost us more. Now, as far as we can tell, South Africa has done 5 out of 22 things the task force drew our attention to. So clearly there's still quite a lot of work to do. Also in South Africa this week is Wole Adeyemo, who is the U.S. Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, essentially the second most powerful politician in the U.S. Treasury. And Deputy Secretary, you were talking in Johannesburg earlier today, urging South Africa to up its battle against corruption. And I wonder if there is a quid pro quo here in terms of the actions that the U.S. government has taken against American company whose corrupt relationship with South African government departments and South African businesses during the Zuma years called their own ethics and perhaps America's own checks and balances into question. Your comment?
So thank you for having me. And I want to be clear. What I said earlier today was that recently my Department of Treasury in the United States put out our national action plan related to anti-money laundering and talked about the impact of corruption in the United States and the actions we need to deal with that. So we come at this conversation humbly, but say that we want to partner with the South African people who have made a commitment rooting out corruption in their country, because it's a fundamentally corruption is a tax imposed by the wealthy and the powerful on average citizens. So our goal is to work closely with South Africa as they make progress to deal with both the fat of gray listing, but also more broadly to try and root out corruption in order to make sure that money is invested in the economy, not illicitly put in the pockets of corrupt individuals.
To the point, though, that there were American-based companies, McKinsey amongst them, who were implicated in state capture. The actions that the American government is taking against those companies, of course, are instrumental in sending a signal to others around the world that that sort of behavior can't be tolerated, no matter where it happens and where you're domiciled, surely.
I think, as I said, we are focused on corruption in the United States, as well as working closely with our partners here in South Africa on ways that we can help them address the ways that corrupt individuals, for example, move money through the traditional financial system and the informal financial system. ultimately, what we know to be true is that in all of our countries around the world, corruption exists. And what we have to do as financial authorities is to work together to make sure that we can expose it. We can make sure that our law enforcement can take action, and we can make sure that the hard won resources of our people are used for productive means.
When we look at South Africa's litany of self-inflicted wounds, we certainly have not been our own best friends in this particular case, from electricity to logistics and scores of other failings. Your boss, Janet Yellen, was here last year and she was pointing out these failings to us, and we feel them each and every single day. When you compare where South Africa was when she was here last year versus what you are witnessing or what your teams are witnessing on the ground, do you see progress? Are we making the sort of progress that Janet Yellen would have liked us to be making this time last year?
So I think one of the things that we have to note is that despite South Africa's challenges, the economy last year still grew. Even though it was modest growth, you still saw an economy that was growing. And our view remains that what South Africa needs to do is address challenges like the challenge of making sure that people have power when they want it, where they want it, and also improving logistics. And doing those two things will help create growth rates that help deal with creating jobs. From the standpoint of your question, when the secretary was here, she outlined the importance of working on these issues. And in my conversations with government officials, but also with business leaders and everyday South Africans, what they've told me is that things are improving. Of course, everyone wants things to improve faster, and we, the United States, wants to be South Africa's partner. And part of that partnership is not just in terms of words and technical assistance, but we and a number of our partners have offered up more than $9 billion in resources as part of the Just Energy Transition Program to help South Africa invest in renewable energy that will help them deal with their climate challenge, but also help deal with the electricity crisis.
Talk to me about South Africa and geopolitics and South Africa's sometimes interesting diplomatic stances on global issues. For example, with respect to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, it's taken a so-called neutral view, but effectively a view that is the antithesis of the view taken by the United States. With Israel's attack on Gaza, South Africa again at odds with U.S. diplomacy. How does our political stance affect our commercial relationship from your point of view?
So today in my speech, I talked about the fact that the United States and South Africa are both boisterous democracies in which we both agree on a great deal, but we also disagree on things. But fundamentally, we agree on more than what we disagree on. For example, Russia-Ukraine. We both agree that Russia's invasion of Ukraine was illegal and a violation of international law. And when it comes to what is happening in Gaza, we both agree that Hamas's attack on Israel on October 7th was a heinous act of terrorism. We both agree that more humanitarian assistance needs to get into Gaza. We both agree that we need a ceasefire. The United States has called on Hamas to accept a ceasefire that includes freeing women and children and injured civilians that will be for 6 weeks and can continue on to more. Fundamentally, these are all things the United States and South Africa agree on. We may take different diplomatic approaches, but ultimately our goal to address these situations in many ways is similar. And where we disagree, we're going to have robust conversations about those issues because we know that that's what democracies do. That's what partners do.
Many small and medium-sized businesses particularly increasingly are dependent on AGOA as a means of getting preferential access to the United States. Can you state unequivocally that as far as least as this administration is concerned, that agreement is not at risk as a result of our government's diplomatic positions, which are often at odds with those of the United States?
So I want to make clear that AGOA is something that our president, President Biden, has said should be extended. And it doesn't only benefit South Africa, as you know well, it benefits 32 countries on this continent. South Africa is one of the biggest beneficiaries. South Africa sent $8 billion worth of goods to the United States, I believe, last year, and more than $3 billion worth of those goods were covered by AGOA, meaning that they were completely duty-free. And our goal is really to deepen that relationship with South Africa. But in our democracy, we have co-equal branches of government. In addition to our executive branch, we have a Congress. And ultimately, our Congress is the one that's going to need to renew AGOA. And from our standpoint, the standards for doing that should still rely on the ones that existed when AGOA was started, which include promoting democracy, caring deeply about human rights, and not taking actions that violate our fundamental national security interest. And our goal is to make sure that as many countries as possible not only qualify for AGOA, but take advantage of AGOA to help build out the economy, not just here in South Africa, but throughout the continent. 1 in 4 people on planet Earth will be from Africa by 2050. And the United States has an interest in making sure that those individuals have access to economic opportunity.
Do you look at, I mentioned Lesetho Kganyogo, a Reserve Bank governor, and if you've been fortunate enough to meet him yet, he's a remarkable human. But I mean, he is of the view that we'll be off the Financial Action Task Force grey list within the next year, by 2025. Have you been able to assess, your team's able to assess whether South Africa is making sufficient progress to allow itself back within the fold of nations, if you like, of trusted partners by 2025? Are you seeing that progress?
So I had a chance to see your talented central bank governor earlier today. And I also had a chance to sit down with my counterparts at your national treasury, where our conversation focused in on illicit finance and specifically on a number of issues relative to FATF. And I was impressed by the progress that they've made, but even more impressed by their commitment. And what your deputy minister of finance said, I think, captured well exactly what you said in your opening, where he said that ultimately what South Africa needs is additional investment. And for international investors, one of the things they consider when making an investment is risk. And dealing with the issues that are identified by FATF is a way to reduce that risk and to make it more likely that investors are going to make the decision to invest here in South Africa. The best part about the FATF process is that it is a process that is technical in nature, which means that politics are not a part of it. FATF has identified things that South Africa needs to do. FATF has identified things that the United States needed to do, and we've taken actions to do them. And I'm confident that South Africa both has the capacity and the ability to deal with the issues that FATF has identified, and by so doing, to put themselves in a position where they take themselves off of the list.
Does the U.S. government have any concerns ahead of our elections in May? You go to elections later on this year, of course. There'll be your own concerns on that particular front. It looks like it's headed to be a very interesting race. But in terms of watching South Africa's transition and South Africa's change into this robust democracy we've been talking about, are you worried about the way in which these elections may turn out and whether or not coalition politics leads to more instability, more indecision, perhaps more uncertainty into the future?
I'm impressed by what South Africa has built in its post-apartheid era in terms of democracy that functions with functioning elections, and we look forward to continuing to celebrate that. My personal background is that decades ago, my parents took me and put me on an airplane from Nigeria and took me to the United States. And I think one of the things that I continue to hope for is that more countries throughout this continent also have the ability to continue to deepen their democratic traditions in the same way that South Africa has done post-apartheid. So we look forward to celebrating their elections. And we know that like any elections, ultimately, the people are the ones who decide.
Wally Adeyemo, thank you very much indeed. U.S. Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, Janet Yellen's deputy in South Africa. And yeah, consummate politician, good answers to questions, some frustrating answers because they're political answers and they're very carefully scripted answers. But at the same time, some assurances there, I believe.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
To Chris Stewart we go, portfolio manager at 91. And there was a nice turn up for the books today, a nice positive day, a little bit of a robust bit of buying across all of the main sectors of the JSE. Chris Stewart.
Yeah, good evening, Bruce. A reasonably positive day today, and in fact, a reasonably positive day globally. We've seen some decent but not too good macro data coming out of Europe and the UK, which I guess continues to support the case for fairly robust economic activity whilst prices continue to come down, hopefully allowing for interest rates to start decreasing around the middle of the year. And, you know, that's carried on into our market. We've seen the Rand strengthening again today, back down at about the 1850 mark. And, a very strong rally in precious metals prices, platinum, palladium, rhodium, the whole PGM basket up quite strongly. Oil price up, gold price up. And we're seeing, a fairly broad-based rally across our market, but in particular, focused in some of the precious metals and diversified mining companies, despite the fact that quite a few of those going ex-dividend today, still some strong gains being posted.
And what about the property sector? Two property companies, two very substantial property companies, big landlords in South Africa's property environment, HighProp and Growthpoint, both coming out with results. HighProp after the market closed. Growthpoint seeing a bit of a drop in profits and a drop in its distributions. How was HighProp?
Yeah, I mean, I guess Growthpoint first, it was, less bad than I think the market expected. They had originally, I think, guided towards 10 to 15% decline in distributable income. That's come in at about 8.5% for the first half, and they've narrowed their guidance range to down 10 to 12 for the full year. So a little bit better there. If you look at the key operating metrics outside of the V&A Waterfront, which continues to defy gravity and is the star of the show, certainly from a Growthpoint perspective. Other parts of their business, moving in the right direction. You're seeing, vacancy rates declining. You're seeing reversion rates less bad than anticipated. So some of the operating metrics looking okay. Unfortunately, any geared company in an environment where interest rates have increased sharply is going to be suffering from a big increase in debt servicing costs and an increase in interest expense over the period. And that's obviously putting pressure, quite a lot of pressure on earnings. Nothing concerning enough to start to result in covenant concerns, but it is, resulting in some caution around distributions and around the promise of distributions, which brings us quite nicely onto HighProp, who, in addition to, suffering from some of the issues in the domestic market, they've got a pretty strong business in Eastern Europe that seems to have gone fairly well over the quarter, but they also have the Ikeja Mall in Lagos, and their Nigerian business putting them under quite a lot of pressure there. They've recognized some foreign currency translation losses as a result of the Naira. We saw a similar effect in Absa's results yesterday, and I suspect we're going to see similar commentary from Standard Bank when they report next week. Anyone with a Nigerian business, and you can only ask MTN that, really struggling with that geography now, and HighProp electing not to pay a distribution at the interim stage, not guiding that they would not meet their distribution outlook for the full year stage, but not paying a distribution at the interim stage.
Chris Stewart, thank you. Portfolio Manager at 91. 6:30 in the Eyewitness News, brought to you by Khalix. Khalix, for the businessman who knows what he wants. Here's Maki Malapo.
Bruce Whitfield on The Money Show.
6 to 8 p.m.
Welcome to The Money Show this Wednesday evening. Norbert Sasser will join us in just a moment. Norbert is the Chief Executive Officer of Growthpoint Properties. And then at 7 o'clock, well, after Eyewitness News at 7 o'clock, Rich Mulholland, the inimitable Rich Mulholland, singing for his supper tonight, because I think he's a little bit worried about artificial intelligence and the impact it may have on people who build their own presentations using artificial intelligence. And I guess there may be a place for it. Personally, I'm a little concerned. So I'm going to invoke a little bit of AI myself, and see whether or not you can tell the difference. See whether or not you can tell the difference between an introduction written by me and an introduction written by artificial intelligence. I think it'll be a little bit of fun on this Wednesday evening. It's been a pretty good day in terms of stock markets. In case you missed it earlier, The JSE rose nearly 1% on the day, and we had a very good session. We ended the day above 74,000. All of the main indices were in the money. Gold price a little softer in rand terms today as the currency has continued on its strengthening path. 18.53 this evening to the euro at 20.28 and to the pound at 23.72. So the currency improving this evening, which is nice to see. Are interest rate cuts coming anytime soon? Well, increasingly, I see Wells Fargo in the United States has pushed out its expectations of US interest rate cuts now from May to June. Interest rates are very important if you are a chief executive in the listed property sector. We'll find out why in just a moment.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
I was at the V&A waterfront recently and I could barely move, which was frustrating. It was early March. There was someone who likes a little bit of space, but the place was humming. And it remains an enormous and important contributor to owner Growthpoint's results. And Norbert Sasse, the chief executive of Growthpoint, is with us this evening. They've had a tough 6 months. And I think by any standards, almost anywhere in the world, Norbert, the V&A waterfront is something of a property investment outlier.
Yes, hi Bruce. I have to agree with that. I think if you consider pretty much all the exposure we have across the globe, and I would argue that that there are not many other listed or unlisted real estate companies for that matter around the globe that have seen the kind of recovery and the kind of performance that the waterfront has seen in the past couple of years, but in particular in the last sort of 6 months. I think nothing short of spectacular, and we're very pleased for that. I guess it's challenging across the portfolio. The waterfront is truly an iconic asset and is truly performing exceptionally well. Strong tourism, obviously very exposed to the tourism market in Cape Town, both local and international tourists. And we were just discussing earlier today, you know, I think the waterfront thrives off what happens at the convention center. There's, you know, that's almost back to normal. It thrives off what happens at the Cape Town Stadium with various concerts, rugby matches, soccer matches. And so it's exceptionally well positioned to pick up all of that trade that takes place.
It's an astonishing space. I don't know, I mean, how you measure footfall there, but you do count the number of people who come in and out. And I may be suffering from recency bias, but it does feel as if it's about the busiest I think I've ever seen it.
No doubt. I think the record number we probably, and we do measure it, and obviously the number of entry points into the waterfront is perhaps not a perfect science, but certainly what we measure, there's the highest ever number was up 25 million for the for the year, the last 12 months, and December in particular was the highest, and driving the spend, you know, the spend at the waterfront across all the retail outlets, the restaurants, the hotels was over 1.2 billion rand in December, the month of December alone. And that surpassed the prior year, the December 22 number, by something like 16%.
That's an astonishing statistic. It really is. But in terms of the group and in terms of your global distribution, of course, you've got businesses in the UK, you've got businesses in Australia and a very substantial operation in South Africa. High interest rates everywhere. And I mentioned a moment ago that there's just less and less prospect of speedy interest rate cuts that were supposed to be happening by now. But inflation has been so stubborn that central bankers have got really cold shivers every single time anybody else cut anywhere near them. And there seems to be an allergy to cutting. It has a negative impact across your entire portfolio, I'm sure.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I guess it's just the nature of the beast. Real estate companies have debt. They fund themselves with debt, substantial amounts of debt. And we know exceptions. So across the various jurisdictions and the portfolios, we have seen the negative impact of interest rates. In fact, we guided at the beginning of this financial year that we thought our earnings would be down between 10 and 15%, and that the majority of that impact, 80% odd of that impact, would be attributable to interest rate increases. So we've actually, we printed a number for the half year, -8.6%, which is a bit better than what we originally guided. But for the year, we still think we're going to be 10 to 12 down. So the second half will be a bit weaker. Again, mainly impacted by the interest rates and the higher for longer interest rates. Bearing in mind our financial year ends 30 June. So whatever the cuts are that are being talked about, whether that be June, July, August, or let's say post-June, not going to impact this financial year. It will hopefully impact and have a positive impact on our FY25 numbers.
Norbert Sasser, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive at Growthpoint Properties. On your next Money Show, our investment school, we revisit the two-pot pension fund saga. Acting Head of Tax and Financial Sector Policy at National Treasury, Christopher Axelson, responding to Bruce Cameron's withering criticism of the new program. We'll also have the CEO of Standard Bank, Sim Chabalala, and Exaro Chief Executive, Nombasa Tsengwa, taking us through results, as well as wrapping it all up with Auric Business Accelerator's Pavlov Fatidis, finding big solutions to small business problems. Next time on The Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Miles Kubeka is probably one of South Africa's more exciting entrepreneurs. The guy is more flexible than a contortionist. He has got the resilience of a tennis ball. He bounces back in ways that I've not seen many people rebound. It first came to our attention when he announced that he was going to be opening up a business called Vuyos in response to the Hunter advert. And he really did live and breathe the dream of Vuyos. And he opened up across the road from Bits on Jan Smuts Avenue. Of course, COVID came along and he started dark kitchens, and he's been doing all sorts of really interesting things. Well, his latest venture is transforming the township grocery landscape, particularly for low-income earners. Miles Kubeka, who is on the line to us this evening, tell us about Twalisa and what your motivation was here, Miles.
Hi, Bruce. How are you?
You know, not as flexible and as nimble as you. I'll tell you that much, because I don't know how you keep up the energy. But I want to talk about that in a moment. Talk to me about Twalisa.
Yeah, an awesome pronunciation there. So Twalisa is basically, it came during COVID in the realization that most people in townships weren't necessarily poor. They were just poorly paid. They had a cash flow issue. And food is sold in pack sizes that rendered them impoverished, even if they had some money in their pockets. So we sell food based on the amount of money you have as opposed to the pack size, because as you would know, food is cheaper in volume. But perversely, people don't realize that that means, you know, a pack size of mealie meal is effectively almost twice as expensive if you're buying it in a smaller quantity.
I remember the late Peter Matlare, who was the boss here at Prime Media and then went on to become the Tiger Brands chief executive. And there was a big strategic discussion as to, you know, whether they should go and do business in Nigeria or not. And everyone said, oh, that sounds like a very good idea. And he then asked the question, who's been to Nigeria? Nobody had. So he took off the board and they went off to Nigeria and had to learn about pack sizes, had to learn about people who buy daily rather than buy monthly. The idea of buying in bulk, as you say, is incredibly compelling if you've, one, got the space or the conditions to store stuff in and the cash up front, of course, to buy food. Vast majority of people, and if you consider unemployment rates in South Africa, you consider that most people survive on social grants in South Africa, that you've got to be thinking differently about how you serve them. And that's what you've approached this, how you've approached this, right?
100%. And Bruce, we didn't invent anything. There's no rocket science here. When I grew up, my mom would send me next door to borrow a cup of sugar or acha. Yeah. It's just that now the next door neighbor doesn't have either, because food has gone remarkably expensive, but particularly for low income earners, you know. So we solve for two problems, the convenience factor that you can buy food based on the amount of money you have in your pocket as opposed to the pack size. But the inadvertent opportunity there also became the fact that we reduced single-use plastics from townships. And with high concentration of people, you can understand how much litter there is if people are buying small single-use pack sizes.
So talk to me about size and scale that you've got so far. I mean, you are with somebody who's not afraid of new ideas. Who is constraining you to make sure that you don't run away with yourself with enthusiasm on this one?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at all the stuff we work on, they're basically platforms. We build stuff and we take a long-term view on things. You know, spaza shops or township retail has been there for years. It took most of us to school. So we know that that platform exists. And in fact, if you look at the total addressable market across the continent, most of the continent, informal trade is bigger than formalized trade, especially in the food space, right? So we know that this has got legs, and we've spent a lot of time, especially with my systems engineer background, I like debugging things. Because when you scale and you've got bugs, you will scale the bugs with the scale, you know. So we've taken the last 2 years sort of being under the radar, understanding what works in communities, what works in different communities, what products work in communities, how people, for example, like load shedding alone has taught us so much in terms of what people buy based on load shedding schedules. So all these things, it's like these insights that we've built that has also informed what products we now store in our stores.
Are you getting commercial support, Miles, as you look to grow, as you look to innovate, as you look to develop? Are you even looking for commercial support?
That's been a very interesting journey. When we have coffee, I'll tell you all about it in more detail. But suffice to say, you know, things like COVID, the war in Ukraine, fuel prices, which obviously then influence, the cost of food based on load shedding for generators and so forth, has made people more willing to try new products than I would have thought before. In other words, when we started, a lot of consumers were not willing to try a new product. So they would try a staple that they know, largely because, you know, when you've got your last R5, you want the rice that's a brand that you know because it's trusted, you know what it's going to do. But I think what we realized after the war in Ukraine and prices kept on going up, oil, like even things like eggs and cooking oil kept on going up, consumers are so stretched now that they're willing to try new products. And what that's taught us is that because they're willing to try new products, the barrier to trying has been reduced. So consumers, as long as the product gives them massive value and quality and it's consistent, they are willing to try and keep using.
Where are you sourcing product from? I mean, you fresh produce comes from the Joburg Fresh Produce Market. Meat comes from one of the big, the big meat companies in South Africa. Are you importing pulses and beans and rice and things directly yourself, or are you going through agents and intermediaries?
So we don't do perishables at this point. So we focus on grains and commodity items as well as home care stuff. So you can buy detergent per cup and so forth. So we currently work, for example, with the pulses and the grains. We work with the farmers directly because that also allows us to push on the savings to the end customer.
It's a lovely tale, and I wish you luck with it. Miles Kubeka this evening. Miles, of course, is the founder of Qualisa, and he's been in the restaurant trade, the dark kitchens trade, and he is a massively creative and enthusiastic and also just inspiring individual, Miles Kubeka. I'm looking forward to that cup of coffee, frankly. Miles, we will do that. And it's not like a Cape Town thing. You know the kiss of death to any relationship is when a Cape Townian says, let's do lunch. Anyway, that's so cruel and unkind. Sorry, Cape Town, but you know it's true. Eyewitness News coming up in just a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
Catch up with Rich Mulholland in just a moment. Wendy Nola also standing by. Wendy Nola, of course, brings us a Consumer Ninja feature every Wednesday evening. And tonight it's that wonderfully thorny topic of what happens when you've just bought a house and you realize that the seller has covered up the cracks, has disguised the rising damp. I'll tell you a tale of a close shave about a dozen years ago. The Money Show brought to you by Absa. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. Absa is a registered FSP. And at 7:30, Stephen Kark, who is the chief executive of a payment solutions company that used to be part of Transaction Capital. In fact, the last time we spoke, Paycorp was part of Transaction Capital and was leaving as part of a private equity buyout. I wonder what they've got up their sleeves. Stephen Kark this evening, coming up at 7:30.
The Money Show.
Business unusual.
So there is a temptation nowadays to get AI to do all of your drudge work. So I've done two things. I've asked ChatGPT to write an introduction to Rich Mulholland about using AI to build speaker presentations. And while it was doing that, I scrolled back to my document and I wrote an introduction as well. I'm going to read you the two introductions and I want you to select which one was written by me and which one was written by ChatGPT. In no particular order, here they go. Welcome back to our radio show. Today, we're diving into the fascinating world of speaker presentations. Joining us is the renowned expert, Rich Mulholland, who will shed light on the latest trend, AI-generated slide presentations. Get ready to learn how this innovative technology is revolutionizing the way speakers engage with their audiences. Without further ado, let's welcome Rich Mulholland. That's one version. The second version is this one. Here it is. Rich Mulholland's a renowned public speaker and owner of Missing Link, an agency that helps speakers become better at what they do. And his business also builds presentations. A lot of people are using AI nowadays to generate presentations. Understandably, Rich is not especially pleased about that. Okay. So which one was mine? Let's see if Rich Mulholland can tell the difference. Which was mine, Rich Mulholland, owner of Missing Link, version one or version two?
Well, Bruce, I hope it was version two.
It was version two. It's so interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's not. It's a little bit too chipper and cheerful and bonhomie and warm and fuzzy version one. Welcome back to the radio show. This innovative technology. But it's what I love about this is that AI's own bias towards AI comes through very, very clearly. Because I asked the question, I said, write a 30-second radio show intro for me to introduce Rich Mulholland speaking on the subject of AI-generated slide presentations for speakers. Now, AI should know who you are. It should know what your business is. Yet it doesn't bring that in. It just looks to promote AI as a useful tool for generating presentations. And I suppose, as you and I might be biased against AI, it is biased in favor of AI.
I guess to some degree, I think it's also a case of the limited amount of context it has. I mean, I do use AI. If I'm doing a new hook for a video, I'll give it my context and then I'll say, write it in the style of public speaker Rich Mulholland. And it says, here, you know, here's an introduction in the kind of edgy style of public speaker known for his bold statements, blah, blah, blah. So it, when you give it the context, it can certainly do a good job as that, but it's very limited and it lacks context. So your intro had a lot more context and flavor that would have been available without, you know, because it exists in your head, whereas the AI only has the information that was in the prompt that you gave it.
Well, it's got information in the prompt that I gave it, but it should also have the entirety of human knowledge, which has been put onto this wonderful thing called the internet to draw upon, shouldn't it?
Yeah, totally. And you know, some of them will do. So Perplexity is more up to date. So it's quite good to use as maybe a search engine for things like that. Whereas ChatGPT has a limited access to the internet. And it will work in certain things, but the only context you gave it in the prompt was to write an introduction to a radio show about AI and presentations. It had no idea whether I would like them or not like them. It had no idea you know, on any context beyond that. Yeah. So all that tries to do is it tries to finish a sentence by making up words as it goes along, drawing from the information it has. And I felt it did a pretty bad job of doing it, especially compared to your one.
Oh, well, thank you.
In this case.
I spent 6 hours working on it, so I would hope so. Now, listen, talk to me then about the pressure that you're seeing. And you, I mean, you're in the business of building presentations, so you have a vested interest here. Let's be clear about that. But are you seeing a lot of people using AI to create their own slide presentations?
Yes, and I think that's a good thing. Right. So AI is not a threat. It's an opportunity. I use AI in every presentation I do. However, what I keep on seeing, I think it's very funny. People keep on sending me these messages. And there's basically, if you go onto LinkedIn and you search for PowerPoint is dead, here are 10 AI tools that you can use today to generate presentations. I mean, there's like thousands of them. People are using AI to copy and paste that post. And it gets sent to me about twice a day by somebody saying, am I worried? And the reason I'm not is for the very thing that we were talking about. So when an AI, I think we need to understand the difference between narrow intelligences and general intelligences. And without going into too much detail, general intelligence is not, we don't have that yet in terms of artificial general intelligence. That's kind of like common sense and able to think about multiple things at once, what we do. Whereas a narrow intelligence is able to think about a specific area and is a specialist in one thing. Most of the AIs we have are large language models. So they're specialists in language drawn from a database. And, you know, we can put other parameters into it to try and make it generate images and visuals. But what people are trying to do is to create a tool in which you could simply give a prompt to, you know, something like Tome and have it generate a full slide presentation with all your slides, all your images, and all your text. The problem is, in many ways, the information it's drawing from is just like everything else. It's drawing from the world's text. But the average presentation is not good. It's below average. So what AI is getting very, very good at doing is making really, really bad presentations very quickly. Now, this will probably improve over time, but I think what is more interesting is understanding what I hope people would do is they would use AI for different elements of presentation generation. So something to help them with their content, their opening, their closing, that might be ChatGPT. Something else maybe to help with some images. Although, you know, I laugh whenever I use AI generated images in a presentation, you can spot them from a mile away. But we need to stop thinking that there is a one ring, you know, one tool to solve them all. We do not have a good Swiss Army knife presentation, AI tool. And presentation development requires multimodal thinking. Therefore, if you're going to use AI to make a presentation, you need to use AIs, plural, and you need to know where to use it.
Okay, give me an example here, Rich, because, I mean, the old-fashioned way of doing it is you sit down, you agonize for a year or however long it takes you. Maybe you write a presentation. Into that, you insert some images, some light, some shade, some serious, some heavy-hitting images, some light images, and you kind of go through quite a creative and artistic process of building something that will keep an audience engaged for half an hour, 45 minutes, or whatever the case might be. How does one go about using AI tools to enhance that process?
So, as you all know, Bruce, a good presentation is written long before it's designed, before it's delivered, right? So we start off by actually creating a very, very good narrative structure. I've actually created a prompt to help me get started, like a master prompt. When I have a core hypothesis about something that I want to present on, I've created a big, long master prompt that I use, and I just have to put in two or three bits of information, and it does a fairly good job of creating a base structure for me to start my research from. If any of your listeners want a copy of that, just they can ping me on LinkedIn, it's no problem, and I'll send that prompt across. Now, that will give me a framework, but what it really does is gives me a point of departure. So I don't pretend that just because it's given me something that's nice and eloquent and it's given me some nice microscripts and content in there, I understand that there's still work to be done because I want to be more than a first pass. So this is what's happening is AI is a tool is making people lazy because people are using it to do the work. And I don't see it. I see it as a research assistant. I see my AIs as an intern. I think we've discussed this before. So once I've got that base, then I go through, then I start doing my own research. And I might jump into something like Perplexity. And there I might start asking for more real-time studies. Here's my hypothesis. Give me an up-to-date study on this. Can you help me with that? Please find me some research data on that. Please include attributions and it'll give me that. Then once I've got that, I will actually build out and flesh out my own presentation framework, maybe using post-it notes because I like to have something visual in front of me. And then at this point, I'll start putting in images. Now, I don't want these perfectly crafted, mundane images. AI-generated images now are the equivalent of stock photographs 2 years ago. You can spot them a mile away. They're as cheesy and as plain to see. And as you can look at any post anywhere in the world and you can see at least a ChatGPT AI-generated image that's generated using DALL-E. If you use Midjourney, it could be better. But there is points in which we want to use these tools, and we can. Then I would jump into your visual tools. So this could be your PowerPoints or your Canvas. And PowerPoint actually has some really good AI tools in it. And in fact, with tools like Copilot coming out imminently, that's going to be super exciting. But then you use those tools for the narrow function of making your slides look beautiful. And then finally, I actually think one of the greatest tools available that's most underutilized is PowerPoint has a really good presentation coach built into it. So if you want to run through your presentation, let's say you're doing a big, you know, analyst presentation or presenting your financial results, you run through your presentation, you just turn on PowerPoint's presentation coach. And at the end of it, it's going to tell you how many ums you did or that you didn't have enough emotional amplitude and where you could speed up. And you can hear recordings of it. You can see analyzed slide by slide data. And it's a really, really powerful tool. It lets you know if you repeat yourself too much. And people aren't using that. And so those narrow intelligences are really, really wonderful when it comes to being better at speaking and presenting.
Ultimately, though, and these are tools. It all comes down to the way in which it's delivered, how it's delivered, whether or not the audience likes, believes you, trusts you. And that is a distinctly human thing, isn't it? And I'm guessing that's why AI can do so much, but not everything.
Well, Bruce, this is the thing that this is why I'm so bullish on presentations at the moment, because when you're standing in front of a human, if you're a human being standing on a stage in front of a group of other humans, it's the last bastion of trust. Right now, for all intents and purposes, we could be having this conversation, we could be sitting having lunch, and we could have used AIs to generate this conversation, and we could be putting this up to the internet, and nobody would know if we're having this conversation right now, and theoretically, that's already possible, and would be quite easy to do using voice models. The video can be faked, we have deep fakes of images. The last area of trust is when you're watching a human stand in front of you delivering a message. And when you're on stage delivering a presentation, it's not just high authority and high attention, it's actually long form. So in a world where everybody wants short bites of content delivered super quickly, and there's low trust in these things, we now have this last medium where we can stand in front of people, they can look at our face, we can deliver messages, and people will buy into it. And it's why I just really do believe that AI has made it more possible for more people to write compelling presentations, but they still have to stand and deliver. And I think that we should be putting up our hand to do that more. It's never been easier to do, and it's never been more important.
Thank you. Rich Mulholland, the owner of Missing Link.
The Money Show.
Consumer Ninja.
To Wendy Nola we go, and we'll get to Wendy in just a moment. Of course, Wendy is our consumer ninja. And tonight, it's all about getting screwed over on a house deal. That's my reading of it anyway. I recall many, many years ago, probably a dozen years ago now, my next door neighbor popped round. And my next door neighbor said, oh, we've just bought a house. And I said, oh, how wonderful, you. Congratulations. That's lovely. And I said, we tried to buy a house recently too, and we got beaten on price. Oh, that's hilarious. And we carried on chatting, and we realized that we'd bid on the same house. We'd be to see the house and to put in an offer within minutes of arriving. And it was a slightly foolish offer, but it was a fair offer. We thought at the time we liked it. It looked good. It was in a nice area. But it was lovely. And it was the most spontaneous we'd ever been on an offer. And the agent came back to us and said, terribly sorry, you're going to have to up your offer because there's another bid and it's X thousand more. And we went, well, why did you cut your commission? The agent refused. And we said, well, perhaps we were a bit too hasty anyway. And we walked away from the deal. A year later, I bumped into an exhausted looking former neighbor. The house was a disaster. It leaked like a sieve. It was shambolic. It was awful. Poor buyers. And we just looked at each other and went, thank goodness for that. That was, we got lucky on that particular one. We got our come up and see us later, of course. Consumer Ninja Wendy Nola is with us this evening. And I think it's a fairly common thing where sellers paper over the cracks, Wendy.
It is indeed, unfortunately, Bruce. I've had many stories over the years from many emails from people who've done just that, and very soon after the purchase of what they thought was their dream home, things went horribly, horribly wrong. The Durban story typically is that the roof was infested with borer, had to have the roof replaced, boundary walls being unsound and collapsing, and you name it. And the problem is that without solid evidence that the sellers were aware of the defect and purposefully failed to inform you, the buyer, you on a hiding to nothing in terms of getting redress. So you do need proof that there was an element of fraud in the seller's actions, right? And so the case study for this week is that a buyer, Ms. Mulman, she took action against the sellers of her Joburg home after the patched-up damp made its presence visible very soon after she signed the sale. Well, she signed the sale agreement and then got the keys, and there she saw all the damp on the walls. And luckily for her, the proof in this case came in the form of a receipt that the contractor who had been contracted by the seller to fix up the damp came to light, and on it was a drum of paint and, get this, 24 kilograms of polyfiller that were bought to repair the, you know, paper over the damp, polyfiller over the damp. So the buyer, Ms. Woolman, in 2021, she took her matter to court. The Ridderport Magistrates Court upheld her claim and ordered the sellers, who had got divorced before the sale, and so they were separately represented and their cases were slightly different, but the divorced sellers were ordered to pay her 244,000 rand odd, almost 245, plus interest, as well as the cost of the suit. But the sellers weren't happy with that. So again, with separate representation and slightly different reasons, they appealed the ruling, and that's how it ended up. The whole thing being rehashed in the Joburg High Court last month, and on the 28th, didn't go well for them. In fact, it backfired spectacularly because the court dismissed the appeal with costs. So we haven't got much time, but it emerged that they'd acquired. Let me cut to the chase. So there was a foot-to-foot clause which anyone that's bought or sold a house recently will know. So you sign that, and then there's this defects disclosure form, which included this paragraph: the seller further confirms that there are no latent defects in any of the following items unless likewise disclosed by placing a cross in the relevant blocks. And there was absolutely no cross placed in the box that was dampness in walls or floors, right? So they didn't disclose it. And it came to light. And it's kind of fraud, Bruce, but it has to be proved. There has to be proof that they deliberately concealed it. And the evidence, without going into too much detail, according to the judge, was that there was a deliberate intention to conceal the fact that there was damp, and by the fact that they papered it over. In fact, it wasn't the first time that it was done, polyfilled over. It had been done you know, several times before. So that obviously they knew it was a problem that was going to keep recurring, and they sought to hide it cosmetically. So that's why the appeal was dismissed. But the big lesson, yes.
Yeah. So I love the fact that Ardeen Wellman took this to court, and I love the fact that she won, and I love the fact that the court did the right thing, and the court then gave a proper hiding to the sellers who had been devious. And what have you learned from this process here, Wendy?
Well, that's what you should have done before you put in that hasty offer because you fell so in love with
But there was time pressure. It was all perfectly legitimate. It was emotional. And the moment we didn't get the house, we went, thank goodness. And a year later, we went double, thank goodness. Reckless. Oh.
Should have done. And everybody listening should do if they buy a house, no matter how in love with it they are, is make the offer to purchase subject to a report from a professional property inspection company. There are many in operation. It doesn't cost all that much relative to, I mean, it costs, I don't know, I haven't checked the prices lately, but, you know, around $5,000-$6,000. We're not talking huge money when you consider what you're paying for a house, right?
Absolutely.
And they will reveal the dodgy boundary wall and the fact that the roof leaks like a sieve and all the other things, damp, rising damp that's just been cosmetically seen to fool you. And then you can either say, right, this is the quote to fix all these things. We really love the house, but we're reducing our offer by X amount. Or you walk away from the deal. And I recently heard from Suzette, who's in the UK, Bruce, and she said, I can't believe that South Africans don't have a survey done when purchasing a property. I did estate agency work for a while after moving here, and they couldn't believe the old footstool rubbish in South Africa. In the UK, it's part of the paperwork to have a written surveyor's report. Having made several moves over the years, it's amazing what the professional finds, especially when the buyers are amateurs. I wish legislation would change in South Africa. This is now me. I wish legislation would change in South Africa to require this inspection report to be mandatory, as it is certainly in the UK, because it would save buyers so much anguish and money. But in the meantime, do it for yourself. Insist on it, even if the state agency tells you, because it's in their interest to tell you, they act for the seller, oh, you're going to lose the sale because the other buyer is not putting such condition. Don't fall for that. Pay the money, get the inspection report. Please, 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 please.
Wonderful. Wendy, I couldn't agree with you. Welcome to the Wednesday evening edition of The Money Show. As always, we bring you somebody who's changing the world, either to a lesser or greater degree, maybe just changing the lives of their own staff and their customers. Stephen Kark is the chief executive of a company called Paycorp. And it feels like a million years ago when I'd last chatted to Stephen Kark. He was in studio, and we were talking about why he was taking Paycorp private out of Transaction Capital at the time. And it's been a while. Time for a catch-up. So, Stephen Kark, I mean, you actually, I think, started this business even further back than that. That was, what, 1999 was the first business, the ATM Solutions business, which installed independent ATMs all over South Africa, right?
Well, firstly, good evening, Bruce. Good to chat to you. It has been about 1,000 years, 10 years ago to be exact. And if I recall, in that last meeting, you were fascinated as to A, why we were taking the business out of Transaction Capital, and B, the price that we paid. So that was sort of the context that I really, really enjoyed that talk. And let's just say that 10 years is a long time in the world of payments. A hell of a lot has happened since then. But this is a business that I started at the end of 1999, early 2000. And the first part of the payments adventure was really putting ATM machines in garage shops and convenience stores and supermarkets. And that was largely against the backdrop at that time of the big banks who were either unwilling or unable to really put ATM machines away from their own branches. So it was few and far between. If you needed an ATM, you invariably had to go to a branch. And, you know, that, as I said, retail location ATMs were not a thing. And that was what we brought to South Africa, where we put machines into convenient locations and we gave merchants the opportunity to better service their customers and cardholders more access to their cash. And that was the start, ATM Solutions.
Imagine making banking and being able to access cash convenient. But the world has moved on. I mean, there are still very cash-dense economies, but more and more in developed economies, we're seeing people going digital. And, of course, you've had to go digital. You launched after ATM Solutions a business called DrawCard, and then, I don't even know how to pronounce this, EFT POS, Electronic Funds Transfer Point of Sale, I suppose that stands for, in 2005. Were you looking at sort of diversification away from cash? Were you looking to create an integrated payments business even back then?
Absolutely. I mean, it wasn't so much a migration away from cash at that time. That ultimately became a theme. But after a pretty successful launch of ATM solutions, and we went from zero to nearly 5,000 ATM machines around the country, which made us the largest network, off-site network, off-bank-site network in the country. We literally blanketed the country from top to bottom, small towns, big towns, with ATM machines. We looked at our business very strategically in the early part of, or the latter part of the early 2000s. And we said, look, we've got very good retail relationships. The retailers, they like us, they know us, they trust us. They were very good to us in the early years. We built a very large and sophisticated transaction processing infrastructure, not because we were so smart, just because we were processing literally hundreds of millions of ATM transactions. So we became, very low cost ability to transact, to process transactions, and a pretty good back office and risk management and all the plumbing that makes an ATM business work. So we looked at this bit at our business very strategically, and we said, look, how do you go from being a reasonably competent ATM deployer, an ATM company, into being more a payments business? And then we branched into those two separate areas. We thought that the big banks were doing a wonderful job of providing, speedpoint machines, POS machines in big retailers. If you're in Pick and Pay or Woolies, that was a great job that they were doing. But in small and medium-sized merchants, you know, if you're Freddy's Shoe Shop or Steve's Pizzeria, you were being overcharged and underserviced. So we thought that was a great segue into independent point of sale, putting out point of sale machines. And then we saw the rise in the U.S. in particularly of prepaid cards, not prepaid airtime cards, prepaid debit cards. And then we formed another company called DrawCard, and that business was one of the pioneer third-party card issuers in South Africa. We started originally with a gift card, and then we got a Visa sponsorship. We started issuing currency cards and loan disbursement cards and all different kinds of card products. So to answer your question, off the backbone of our ATM business, we diversified into other payment streams. Was that because we were looking to diversify away from cash? Probably not. We were not that prescient. But it did give us the raw material to move into other payments verticals.
Now, it's so interesting, isn't it? I mean, the world of payments, the stuff we take for granted, because it just happens. You tap your card, swipe your card, stick your card into a machine, tap in a PIN number. Sometimes you don't. Now you tap your phone. Whatever the case is, we take it all for granted. And it's the architecture of what makes commerce possible that you've been instrumental in for more than 20 years now. You then sell it into Transaction Capital. And by 2012, I think it was, Actis, the private equity firm, and you as manager, management team, paid 937 million rand to take it out of Transaction Capital. And you've been what, an independent business ever since?
Yeah, so the Actis adventure was very good. Actis, as you know, a big private emerging market private equity shop. They loved the payments business. They owned a number of payments assets around the world, and they identified Paycorp as a good one. So them, together with us as the management team, bought it out of Transaction Capital. And Bruce, our strategic objectives were very clear and actually very simple, to be honest. The execution was a bit complicated, but the strategy was very simple. We thought we were going to build out value, real equity value, by doing only two things. Number one, internationalizing the business. And number two, diversifying somewhat into other payments verticals, into different verticals. So, and we did pretty well over a 8-year period that Actis was involved with us. On the international front, we went into Eastern Europe. We thought that there were similar market characteristics in the ATM space in Eastern Europe. And I mean, just to digress for 30 seconds, we had a bit of experience operating ostensibly an international business in Namibia, where we still have today nearly 600 machines. We got a handful of people working there. Why? Because all the heavy lifting is done from our central infrastructure in Johannesburg. So we like that model where you can go into a market, you can deploy relatively light infrastructure, and you can do all the heavy lifting from South Africa. And that's scalable. That in our mind was scalable. So that was the international strategy that we pursued. We went into Eastern Europe. We got introduced to some fantastic entrepreneurs there. We landed up ultimately having a controlling stake in that business. And today we have ATMs close on 12 or 1300 machines in Hungary, Slovakia, Czech, Croatia, and the surround, all through Central and Eastern Europe. And we're looking at a couple of other markets there, again, with all the heavy lifting done from central infrastructure in Sandton. So very scalable and very profitable. So that was, if you like, you know, international opportunity number one. And international opportunity number two is we made a pretty smart acquisition. We bought a company called Tutuka. We took a majority stake of that. Yes. We merged that with our draw card business. And we sold the Tutuka business just before COVID, which I'll talk about in a second. But just before we sold them, I think if my memory serves me correctly, we were in 33 countries. We were issuing cards around the world, all processing from South Africa. So the trick is to be internationally outstanding while still being locally relevant. We like that.
Absolutely. And you've got a cost base in an environment which for many years, and hopefully it doesn't continue in perpetuity, you'll have a different view, of course, where a weakening currency environment has made you even more profitable as a result of where you've domiciled the costs.
Yeah, I think that's right. And look, you don't only want to be a cost, you don't only want your leadership to come through cost benefit, but of course, having your central infrastructure in South Africa, which is a low-cost base, low-cost environment, it does help. But we have managed to remain current and relevant to the top end of technology. So there is nothing that people are doing anywhere around the world, if it's in ATM or transaction processing or otherwise, that we currently don't have either the expertise or currently doing it ourselves. You know, the interesting thing about payments, why we like that as a business, and you alluded to it earlier, is any commercial transaction that takes place, the final step is always the payment. So our trick now today is to utilize our core payments infrastructure to assist either merchants, banks, cardholders to pay any way they like. So if they want to be paying in cash, if they want to be tapping and going, if they want to be providing a card, or if they want to be paying in crypto, that's, you know, our kind of our strap line is pay your way, meaning pay any way you like. We don't want to be too prescriptive to say, well, this market is going cash light, this market is going crypto heavy, this is digital currency, this is card. We want to be a utilitarian provider of payment services off a low-cost base in South Africa.
We're talking to Stephen Kark, the chief executive of PayCorp. More with him in a moment. Welcome to The Money Show. Stephen Kark with us this evening, chief executive at PayCorp. And there are plenty of references, Stephen, to Transaction Capital's sale of PayCorp to Actis for 937 million rand. In those days, it was 10 rand to the dollar. Now it's twice that, of course. And you referred earlier to Actis exiting PayCorp. I think that's at least what you suggested. When did that transaction happen?
Actis were involved with us, Bruce, for about 6 years. As I said, the key strategy for what we believed would be value unlock would be into internationalize and to broaden our product scope, which we did both of those things reasonably well. And then towards the end of 2018, we were the last investment in their fund and they were looking to monetize. I thought it was a bit premature, but be that as it may, they did have a majority. So we went to exit at the end of that year. We ran a process. We actually got offers in for the entire group. We didn't think at values that we thought represented enough value. Actis would have done still absolutely fine. They made a very healthy return. But it was decided that the best way to extract value or maximum value would be to do a breakup and sale, piecemeal sale. You know, some of the potential purchasers said, look, I love the ATM business, but I hate the card business. I like the card business, but I hate the POS business, you name it. So we decided to do the breakup. The first asset that we sold was Tutuka, which was our card issuing business. We sold that in May of 2019. And then at the end of that year, we sold our point of sale, our merchant acquiring business. And during the intervening period when Access was involved with us, we bought a fantastic business doing airtime, electricity, mobile top-up, lotto, remittance, putting these small terminals in informal retail. We grew that thing from a couple of thousand merchants to, I think, close on about 40,000 merchants when we sold. We also powered those devices to start accepting cards as cash became, less relevant. So we sold that business at the end of 2019. And then COVID happened. Actis, we sat tight during COVID. We were left with our big network of machines, nearly 7,000 machines in South Africa or sub-Saharan Africa and Europe. And I mean, COVID was tough. I mean, stores were closed. Eastern Europe was closed. We were fortunate that our balance sheet was very strong as a result of these sales. But we popped out of the other end of COVID very strong, a talented management team. And Actis expressed interest in selling the last assets, our ATM business and our processing infrastructure. And then through a number of conversations, we decided that the best buyers for that group was us as a management team. So we bought it out again. So myself and my management team bought it back again, and we are now in growth mode. We have we bought back our network of machines, all of our processing infrastructure, and that was a little after 18 months ago, and it's been a hell of a thing since then. We've grown the business. We have retooled the business, repurposed it. We're in the UK. We're in a number of other countries. We have a very strong lending business, which, you know, lends to merchants through their point of sale device or through their ATM machine. We've moved quite aggressively into crypto. We let people cash money out of ATMs, you know, cardless, if they've got a mobile wallet. And believe it or not, all during this time too, we made an application to the Saab for designation. That effectively puts us in the same status as a clearing bank, which they granted to us kindly over a year ago. So we are now principal members of Visa and MasterCard ourselves, which gives us enormous capabilities and optionality. So, you know, if you think about the ATM business, perhaps if you think about the ATM business as, I don't know, white bread. You know, not everyone likes white bread and is going down in popularity. We don't see ourselves as being in the white bread business. We see ourselves as being in the bakery business. We have got, you know, ovens and the supply chain and pastry chefs and whatever kinds of transactions we can plug into our environment. If it's card or point of sale or crypto or person-to-person payments or mobile, it runs through this central infrastructure. So our key is to take this core asset, which was developed in its embryo more than 20-odd years ago in the ATM business, and continue to build out our payments capabilities internationally.
Yeah. What did you learn in the private equity process? I remember asking Christo Visa, this was before Steinhoff, the week before Steinhoff, actually. And I just said to him, you know, what was the biggest lesson you learned along the journey of creating this enormous empire of retail effectively? And he just said, if you'd never been forced to list the business of ShopRite in 1985, or was it 86, during the crisis that was precipitated by the Rubicon speech, he would never have done so. But they needed to raise capital, and so he did so. I wonder if you've learned anything from the private equity process as to whether you would take the same decisions given what you know now and put into a similar position.
Well, life's a lot clearer through the rearview mirror than through the windshield, that's for sure.
Absolutely. But,
our experience with private equity has been pretty good. We had Horizon Equity in the early days. We had Ethos and Actis more recently. We also were listed through Transaction Capital. So The positives from a private equity perspective is, of course, they give you capital. They also open certain doors, and there's definitely a skill set that they bring to you. Our business today, it's almost second nature to have, you know, a risk committee and an audit committee and all of the necessary stuff that you need by having professional owners. So there's no doubt that we are a much more professional shop as a result of having private equity owners. But Bruce, the truth is, I'm not sure I would do a private equity deal again easily. Certainly not private equity that comes from a closed-end fund, you know, because, you know, capital needs to be patient. You know, invariably you buy too early, yeah. sell too early, buy too late, who knows? And when you've got this artificial thing of a clock ticking in a private equity universe, it's weird. You're signing a divorce decree while you're still under the wedding canopy, which makes not a lot of sense. So private equity has been very good for us. We've had excellent partners. Actis were good partners. Ethos was good partners. Really fantastic. But in the next iteration of our journey, we would look, to the extent we need to raise funding, we'd do it more through permanent capital rather than something that's got a clock ticking. I just think it's somewhat short-sighted, invariably.
And you would have learned lessons looking at your friends from Transaction Capital, of course, in the last 2 years or so, as the wheels, when they come off quite spectacularly, publicly and loudly. And that becomes very distracting, too, for anybody who's trying to build a business.
Well, look, you know, I like being private. The public light is not a forgiving friend, I'll tell you what. You know, when it's running, everyone's your friend. When it's not, wow, friends are few, I'll tell you what.
Yeah. So, I mean, some valuable lessons learned. The valuation of the business, did you pay considerably more to take it out of private equity than they paid going in?
Suppose when you total it all up, when the original transaction that we had when we bought it out of Transaction Capital was at 937, correct? We made some acquisitions and we grew aggressively organically. So the check that Actis got out in totality, when you factor in all of the assets that we had bought and grew, they did fine. They did absolutely fine. So your skepticism around the entry price, I think was probably ill-founded. They did absolutely fine. But the last transaction that in the final asset that we bought, it was okay. It was okay. We paid probably more than we thought we should have, and Actis decided that we probably paid less than we should have. But anyway, everyone was equally unhappy.
Perfect. The perfect transaction. Stephen Karp, good to catch up. Thank you for joining us this evening. Chief Executive at Paycorp. Fascinating tale of the evolution of a really interesting business. Stephen Karp joining us this evening as they've globalized a business with the base, the costs, the engine room still very much in South Africa.